Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. Usual two guests up today. First, in a few minutes, we'll hear from Lane Kenworthy, a sociologist who studies income and poverty around the world. He'll talk about what makes it possible for the poorer half of the population to enjoy some of the fruits of economic growth. Spoiler alert, we in the U.S. aren't doing it. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll hear from investment strategist, who despite that choice of occupation is a good guy, Enrique Diaz-Alvarez, on the euro crisis, with an emphasis on his home country, Spain. Before all that, some words in the news, private equity specifically. As we're now hearing in some detail, Mitt Romney made himself very rich in that line of work. He's now worth, in the monetary sense, about $250 million, which makes him a piker next to the real hotshots in the Forbes 400. But as Bloomberg Businessweek put it the other day, if the 1% had a 1%, Mitt would be a member in good standing. So what about this private equity, or PE racket? Here's how it works. A group of operators, like Mitt's Bain Capital, raises money from big institutional investors like pension funds and rich individuals that forms a core equity base for their adventures. And then they arrange to borrow much, much more. They scour the landscape for appropriate targets to buy up and work their magic on. That magic can take several forms. The industry's publicists would have you believe that they can transform troubled firms by injecting fresh capital and management and thereby turning them around. That happens sometimes, but what happens more often is they find an established firm, close plants, cut pay, fire workers, sell off underperforming divisions, and then pay themselves big fees. They often load up the target companies with a lot of debt so they can pay themselves big dividends. If all goes well for the PE guys, they make a ton of money in the process, especially if, after a few years, they sell the company to someone else or float its stock in a public offering. The target companies, though, often don't do so well. I should say that this refers to only one type of private equity fund. Venture capitalists who provide seed money to new or very young firms are another kind. They too can get very rich, but they don't have the ghoulish reputation that the likes of Bain, which work mainly on older established targets, have earned. In dollar terms, venture capital is actually quite small relative to buyout titans like Bain, not to mention the far, far larger stock and bond markets. Back to Bain-style PE. So what's the real record of these guys, aside from the fact that they can get very rich? A recent study by five economists, led by Stephen Davis and John Haltewanger, looked at about 25 years of PE experience. They found several things. First, employment at PE-targeted establishments declines by considerably more than it does at a control group of otherwise similar entities who are exempt from the PE magic. Declines by 3% more over 2 years and 6% more over 5 years. But they also found that PE guys move the pieces around a lot, acquiring and divesting divisions and entire firms, moving workers from one site to another, and so on. If you include all that, then the PE hit to employment is only about 1% worse than the control group. But how comforting is that? If you lose your job because of PE-mandated cost-cutting, it's not much solace the higher-ups are buying up other companies where employment might be expanding. Also, turnover increases tremendously after a PE takeover. Workers are hired and fired with furious speed. When you're Mitt Romney or a professional apologist, you can cite Schumpeter on creative destruction. It's not so easy to do that if you're an ordinary worker. At best, you could find your head spinning. At worst, you could end up living in your car, if it doesn't get repossessed. The Wall Street Journal looked specifically at Bain's deals and found that 22% of their targets filed for bankruptcy and another 8% ran into serious trouble. That's nearly a third. Experts at the Journal consulted said that the rate at which Bain's targets ran into trouble was higher than its comrades in the PE business, but Bain did provide spectacular returns for investors. Back after a musical break to talk about just how much growth trickles down. Thank you. I was some of Vogel als Prophet, Bird as Prophet, one of Robert Schumann's Waldszenen, the forest scenes performed by Claudio Arrau. My first guest is Lane Kenworthy, a professor of sociology and political science at the University of Arizona. Kenworthy did a study for the Resolution Foundation, a British nonprofit that specializes in issues around people with low and moderate incomes. His paper compares the experience of 17 countries over the year 1979 to 2005 to see how much GDP growth trickles down to the bottom half of the population and why. I think our use of percentiles in this discussion is self-explanatory, but in case this is an unfamiliar concept, here's an example. Someone with an income at the 10th percentile is richer than 10% of the population and poorer than 90%. Someone with the 50th percentile, also known as the median, is right at the middle of the income distribution. Okay, here's Lane Kenworthy. Welcome, Lane Kenworthy. You've got a paper came out a couple of months ago on what determines the well-being of households in the bottom half of the income distribution. A lot of international variation. First of all, what's happened to, in various countries to people in the bottom half of the income distribution?
Well, what I look at in this report is specifically changes over time in household income, so including government transfers and subtracting out taxes. So it's kind of final disposable income, if you will. And what I'm interested in is, in all of these countries, the economy's grown at varying rates, but actually with less variation than a lot of people think. There were some spectacular success stories like Ireland and some slower growing countries, but economic growth was pretty decent and not too dissimilar in most of these countries. And so what I'm interested in looking at is the degree to which that trickled down, if you will, or reached low to middle income households. So those are households above the bottom tenth of the income distribution and below the median. So from the 10th to the 50th percentile.
Just before you proceed, why do you exclude the bottom 10%? Are they presumably not working?
Actually, many of them aren't working, but in fact, because I was doing this report for the Resolution Foundation, they've set up a commission on living standards, and they've been doing a lot of work, both in-house and contracted with some outside people like me, specifically on this issue of living standards and changes in living standards for this group of people. So that's what they were interested in. It happened to dovetail kind of nicely. I just finished a book that looked specifically at the bottom 10%, and so this was in some ways extending the research that I had previously done.
Okay, back to the topic.
Yeah, so you might expect that the differences across countries in the degree to which incomes grew among this group from the 10th percent up to the median were due largely to how much the economy grew, but it turns out that although there is some correlation between those two things, it's not that strong. Most of the differences across the countries were due to other things, to the degree, again, the degree to which economic growth ended up reaching this group of households. I guess I should say that the United States was one of the countries that doesn't do so well here. In the mid to late 1990s, there is a brief period where incomes go up for this group, but otherwise, they're close to stagnant across this whole time period, which again is roughly 1979 up to the mid-2000s, so it's before the economic crisis hits. And it covers nearly three full business cycles, and there was really only a patch of about 4 or 5 years in that whole period where American households in this group experienced income rises.
So you divide the countries into three categories. Ireland did very well, but I imagine that's mostly been reversed in the crisis of recent years. But what about the other? How did the other countries shake out?
Yeah, so that's kind of an arbitrary grouping, but it's somewhat useful. So Ireland's an example of a country that just had phenomenal growth for household incomes, and as you said, we don't know for certain because the data, at least cross-national comparative data, aren't available yet. But it's very likely that at least some of that, if not a good bit, has been lost in the last few years due to the collapse of the Irish economy. But it did do really, really well. Especially between the early 1990s and the mid-2000s. And a lot of that did trickle down to households below the median. That was true even for the bottom 10% I found in the earlier work I had done. So Ireland's kind of an exceptional case. It had phenomenal economic growth, and a lot of it reached the bottom through all sorts of mechanisms, growing employment, rising wages, and increases in government transfer payments. Those are the three main sources of income for people or households in this group. Then there are a number of countries that did pretty well, where you see, as the economy grows, a fair amount does reach these households in the form of income growth. And then some other countries like the United States, although it's not alone, where either throughout the whole period or for most of the period, as in the U.S. case, there really wasn't much income growth, despite fairly robust, at least decent economic growth throughout the period.
That great doctrine of American politics, the rising tide lifts all boats, isn't automatically true.
No, absolutely not. And as I said, it doesn't hold true in some other countries as well. But certainly that's been the case here. And it's most people are aware of this, but it's worth repeating that, or reiterating that it was the case that the rising tide lifted almost all boats in the decades between World War II and the early to mid to late, it kind of depends on where you put the precise dating, 1970s. But at least since the late 1970s, it really hasn't been true except for in the mid to late 90s.
And that period was one when the unemployment rate briefly dipped below 4%, right?
Yeah, that's right. And rising wages were an important part of the story. It's hard to attribute what happened in the late 90s mainly to employment, because the employment rate was rising throughout these decades, up until the 2000s anyway, and then the employment growth slowed way, way down even before the crash in 2008. But in the 1980s and 1990s, the employment rate was going up. Government transfers were pretty stagnant. They more or less kept pace with inflation, although that varied depending on the particular program you're talking about. But they didn't really rise for the most part, with the exception of Social Security benefits, beyond the rate of inflation, which is to say that they fell behind the economy. As the economy was growing relative to inflation, government transfers weren't. And wages were, again, in this part of the distribution anyway, when you're talking about the bottom half, were pretty much stagnant except for that period in the mid to late 1990s. So it was largely the rise in wages that accounts for this. And there are various stories about why that was the case, but my view, I think, is probably similar to what it sounds like yours is, which is that very low unemployment rate, very tight labor market was likely the key to the story.
Yeah, if you don't have a strong welfare state, nothing like a 3 and change unemployment rate. Now, what other countries did reasonably well in your study?
Well, it's kind of a mix, and this is a little bit interesting in the sense that there's no real clear-cut story about different types of nations. All of the Nordic countries did quite well. Norway is in that exceptionally good performing group, along with Ireland. But Norway has a lot of oil wells, so you could try to tell a story that says Norway has all the right institutions and policies, and I'm kind of partial to that story, but it's not really a fair test case because it's got this oil well. But Sweden and Denmark and Finland also did fairly well. They're in the moderately successful group. But so, for example, is the United Kingdom, a country that's often kind of lumped in with the United States as a nation with a not exceptionally generous set of social programs and a fairly deregulated labor market, a now fairly weak union movement. But it did quite well, especially in the period from the mid-1990s up to the mid-2000s. And there are some countries that you might not necessarily expect that didn't do very well, again, meaning that household incomes for this group between the 10th percentile and the median didn't rise much during this period. They include Germany and Switzerland. Germany has an excuse because of reunification, but that's not the whole story in Germany.
I want to come back to the German story, but back to Britain. Those were mostly the years of the Labour government, Blair and then Gordon Brown. Did they do something policy-wise that led to this outcome?
Yeah, they actually did quite a bit, although they didn't really talk about it a lot. They didn't want to talk a whole lot about redistribution or expansion of the public safety net. But it is the case that quite a number of government transfer programs, some heavily targeted, some more universal like pensions, were kind of slowly but very steadily increased during these years. And that's what helped, one of the things that helped. That's not the whole story in the UK. They also benefited from a very strong economy and employment growth and rising wages up until around 2003. So unlike in the United States, where we just had one very brief period during this nearly three-decade set of years where wages rose. In the UK, they rose for almost the entire period up until about 2003, 2004. But yes, some transfer programs were important. They also have a policy very similar to our earned income tax credit, which is somewhat unique among these nations, but tends to help a fair number of households in this group, as long as they have someone employed. It's a what I call an employment conditional subsidy to low earnings. And they also introduced a statutory minimum wage, which helped to offset the weakening of the union movement in the UK. Not fully, but it certainly helped.
Which I believe is considerably higher than our minimum wage, right?
It is higher, and very importantly, it was increased over time. So there's a different setup in the UK, unlike here, where it's simply up to Congress and the President to decide if and when they want to increase the minimum wage. There's a minimum wage commission in the UK, which reaches not formally binding, but what in practice have been very influential, or makes recommendations, I should say, that Parliament has almost always followed as to whether and how much the minimum wage should increase year by year. So instead of going, you know, 5 or 10 years between increases in the minimum wage, which means it falls further and further behind inflation, they've tended to have their minimum wage not only keep up, but actually rise faster than inflation.
I'm speaking with Lane Kenworthy, who's a professor of sociology and political science at the University of Arizona.
And a surprise in this, well, not to me, but I imagine to a lot of people, is Germany's low ranking. And you write a bit about this elsewhere, too, that Germany has developed a considerable low-wage labor market over the last decade. Could you talk some about that?
Yeah, it's a result of three different things, which are somewhat linked, but in some ways separate developments. So one, of course, is unification. Germany, in effect, annexed a very poor country around 1990. Much of the economy in the former East collapsed, and so a lot of people were out of work. Slowly over time, there's been a kind of slow redevelopment of manufacturing and other types of firms in the East. But a lot of people left the East and tried to come West, and many others remained unemployed. And wages fell or didn't increase as much as they otherwise would, in part because of that. A second development has been the slow, not quite collapse, but weakening of collective bargaining. So it's long been the case that in Germany unions are very powerful, but they never really had as part of their membership a huge share of the labor force like exists, for example, in some of the Nordic countries. So even at its peak, only about, I think, 35% or 40% of German employees were members of unions. But there was a very strong pattern bargaining system, so that wage agreements in the metalworking sector tended to be followed by a lot of other firms throughout the economy. This was all done informally, but it worked in practice for a very long time. And that's slowly fallen apart over the last couple of decades, so that certain sectors and certain firms within sectors decided at various points in time that they were no longer going to follow the wage agreements set in the metalworking sector and a few other very, very important influential sectors. And then the third development has been the kind of formal introduction of a low-pay sector, which came with the so-called Hartz reforms in the early 2000s, where the German government created a new type of job, very short-hour jobs, so people that are working a very small number of hours per month can get paid below the collectively bargained minimum wage. There's never been a statutory, that is to say, government-set or government-imposed minimum wage in Germany, because the collective bargaining system has always been strong enough that there was never a felt need for that. So the wages of these so-called mini-jobs were allowed to be below the collectively bargained minimum wage. And that group of employees expanded really rapidly. It got up as high as 15%. I'm not sure what the current figure is, but as of 5, maybe 10 years ago, it reached as high as 15% of the entire German labor force. So that's a lot of people earning a fairly low wage rate. So those three developments together have meant that German wages haven't increased much, especially in the bottom half of the distribution, haven't increased much, if at all, for much of the period, at least since 1990. Germany also hasn't seen much of a rise in its employment rate. That's a story that's pretty familiar to a lot of people. You know, up until the crisis hit in 2008, Germany was one of those cases that were often contrasted by those advertising the American model as having sluggish employment growth and very high unemployment compared to our so-called great American jobs machine. So that's kind of a familiar story. But put those two things together, the slow wage growth and very little employment growth, and it's not so surprising that you have little increase in household incomes for those below the median, below the middle.
So to get to your major finding, since there are not all that much difference in economic growth rates among the sample that you looked at, what were the major factors that really determined how well people from 10 to 50 did?
Well, there are different stories in each country, but generally speaking, I think it's useful to think about this group of households as consisting of two different groups. So in the analyses I did, I split the bottom part, which is households from the 10th percentile up to the 25th, and then the households from the 25th up to the median. And there are two kind of different stories for these groups, although they're not completely different.
You could call the first the poor, excluding the very poor, and then the second one, people on rather modest incomes.
Yeah, something like that. For the lower group, those between the 10th and the 25th percentiles, when household incomes went up over time, it was almost entirely because government transfers went up. And there's no real key policy that separates some countries from others. Instead, what tended to happen is that in some countries, and again, the UK, maybe somewhat surprisingly, but it's one of the countries where most transfer programs, from pensions to this working tax credit, which is like our earned income tax credit, to more social assistance type policies, to certain types of very targeted and smaller benefits, all of them tended to increase over time in a way that beat inflation, that was faster than the rate of inflation, so that they more or less kept up with economic growth, whereas in the U.S., that simply wasn't the case, with the exception of Social Security. For the group of households from the 25th up to the middle, so those on modest incomes, let's say, it tended to be more of a mix between earnings growth, and in some cases that came mainly because more people were employed or those who already had been employed got to work more hours, and in some cases it came from rising wage levels, and in some instances from both. So that was part of the story, but government transfers often were, even for this group, you know, those going right up to close to the midpoint of the distribution, government transfers tended to be a non-trivial part of the story. So generalizing for this second group of households on modest incomes, it was, you know, roughly half rises in earnings and half rises in government transfers.
But putting that together suggests that the state of the labor market in most countries is really takes a backseat to how generous the transfer programs are.
Yeah, not always a backseat, but it certainly isn't always. And this surprised me. I wasn't so surprised to find that was the case for those lower households from the 10th up to the 25th percentile. But getting higher in the income distribution, I thought it would be almost always the case that wages and employment would be the whole story when household incomes were rising. So, yeah, I was a bit surprised to find how important government transfers have tended to be. And that was true even in the very successful countries like Ireland and Norway, where the labor markets were really, really strong. You know, the economies were growing very, very fast. Employment rates were rising, wages were rising, and yet even there, government transfers were important. Now, if you step back and think about it a little bit, maybe it shouldn't be so surprising. Part of the story there is pensions. Pension benefits tend to be pretty generous. And so a non-trivial share of the people in that group are elderly retired households who are drawing a pension benefit. And in some countries, other types of benefits are quite generous, too. In the Nordic countries, just to use an example, unemployment benefits will tend to pay you somewhere in the neighborhood of 80 to 90% of your former earnings. So if you happen to be a kind of low to middle paid employee and you get laid off and you're unemployed for 6 months or maybe the whole year, you're likely to be drawing a fairly generous benefit that might well put you in that group of households from the 25th to the 50th percentile. And so if those benefits are going up over time, which they were in some countries, not so much in others, then that accounts for part of the reason why these benefits are generous. The earned income tax credit, working tax credit type benefit in the U.S. and more so in the U.K. is another good example. You can get that benefit even when you're not right down at the bottom. It's more generous for those at the bottom, but it benefits some households above the 25th percentile as well.
And finally, we have a lot of political debate in this country over the progressivity or lack thereof of our tax system. But in your international comparisons, it seems like the tax system is not really where the action is when it comes to improving the law to the bottom half. It's really in transfers, right?
Yeah, certainly. Of course, there's some classification issue here because increasingly in the U.S. And this is true in other countries too. The U.K. is a good example, and some of the European countries are now starting to move in this direction. Some of what really amount to cash transfers now come through the tax system as reductions in your tax payments or refundable tax credits, like our earned income tax credit. Sweden now has something kind of similar, although it's structured a little bit differently. So if you classify those as part of the tax system, then increasingly it is the case that that taxes matter. But in practice, those amount to cash transfers. I guess I should say that if you think about contributions to reduction of inequality, which is a somewhat different, although related issue to the degree to which household incomes are rising over time, then what separates the rich countries from one another is not so much the progressivity of their tax system. Instead, it's the degree of transfers. And that hinges much more on the amount of money they raise in taxes rather than the progressivity of the tax system per se.
And parenthetically, there's some talk here about reforming our tax system to be more of one on consumption than income, and supposedly that fosters growth. Did you find anything to support that?
No, I don't think from the existing experience, it's very difficult to trace any link between the degree to which the tax system relies on consumption taxes versus income or let's say payroll taxes or other types and the rate of economic growth. I guess I'll say that consumption taxes can be a very useful means for raising revenue. And so, you know, I personally think we could certainly use more revenue in our tax system for a variety of reasons. And so I wouldn't be opposed to introducing a consumption tax of some sort if it were tacked onto the existing tax system. Now, much of the debate that goes on here consists of arguing for a consumption tax as a replacement for income taxes. And I don't think that'd be a particularly good idea.
But it also matters a lot what happens on the other side, what happens to the revenue.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you can raise more revenue and not have it go to very useful purposes.
I was Lane Kenworthy, a professor of sociology and political science at the University of Arizona. You can find his paper on the website of the Resolution Foundation at resolutionfoundation, all one word, resolutionfoundation.org. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back to talk Euro crisis after a musical break. Some of Too Many Kids Finding Rain in the Dust by Nicholas Jar, or is it Jar? Sorry, don't know. Now to Europe. On Thursday of this past week, Mario Draghi, head of the European Central Bank, ECB, said that the financial crisis in his continent was stabilizing. On Friday, Standard & Poor's downgraded the bonds of France and Austria, apparently not having gotten the news from Draghi, from AAA to AA+. Germany, the Netherlands, Finland, and Luxembourg are the remaining AAAs in the old world. Funnily enough, the interest rates on Austrian and French bonds declined despite the downgrade. Actually, maybe this isn't a surprise. About a week before Standard & Poor's downgraded the U.S., 10-year treasuries were yielding around 3%. The day of the downgrade, last August 5th, the yield was 2.58, nearly a half point lower. As I'm recording this, it was 1.85%, down nearly three-quarters of a point since the downgrade, and only a few hairs higher than AAA Germany. Japan, which has been downgraded something like 13 times over the last decade, pays under 1% on 10-year bonds, considerably less than either the U.S. or Germany. Evidently, downgrades are buy signals. Here to talk about the euro crisis is Enrique Diaz-Alvarez. When he was last on his show to discuss the euro crisis in April 2010, Enrique was working for an unnamed hedge fund. He's now working for a foreign exchange firm, Iberi Partners, as its chief strategist, dividing his time between Madrid, his hometown, and New York. Enrique Diaz-Alvarez. Welcome, Enrique. So it looks like the United States economy seems to be one of the brighter spots in the world today, and the rest of the world is kind of deteriorating. Is that a fair perception?
I think so. I think that, in fact, the in what used to be the secular structural problems of the U.S. economy are actually a blessing in this context, because I think its dependence on domestic demand and its relatively small export sector are precisely what is insulating it relatively well from the disaster that is unfolding across the Atlantic.
And also the political paralysis has kept us from embracing the austerity craze.
Yes, I think that different countries have different taboos about fiscal policy and monetary policy, and the U.S. particular taboo about the reluctance to increase taxes is actually serving its economy rather well in this context.
All right, let's talk some about Europe. Your home country, Spain, is at the leading edge of crisis. Is it beginning to show some of the signs that Greece and Ireland showed a couple of years ago?
I think that it's, in fact, following the script almost to a T. The austerity package, the initial austerity package was passed in May of 2010, which was a little over a year after Greece started, actually 6 months after Greece passed its austerity package. And since then, the economy has failed to grow. It hasn't quite collapsed the way the Greek and the Irish economy have, but it failed to grow. And the new government that took over from the socialists after the November election has just announced that Spain is again in recession. The levels of employment destruction over the last 3 months are very close to the levels that we saw during the Lehman crisis. And not surprisingly, the deficit target for 2011, which was 6% of GDP, will not be met, and the deficit will come in somewhere above 8%.
Well, now, what about the fundamentals, presuming those still matter at all? Is Spain's underlying productive economy in better shape, worse shape, about the same shape as Greece's and Ireland's?
I think it is in better shape than Greece, which is, of course, a fairly low standard. I think that the structural situation is, if anything, much more problematic than Ireland. First of all, with austerity measures being imposed from Frankfurt mostly, the only way out for the Spanish economy, the only way to generate employment, which is badly needed, is through exports. And the Spanish export sector is about 30% of GDP, which is, in relation to the size of the economy, is considerably smaller than Ireland. Also, unlike Ireland, Spain has failed to solve its most serious structural problem, which, to give the Germans their due, Spain did have and still has a massive structural problem, which is housing costs, which is what some people look at as housing prices are actually the housing costs that are embedded in workers' pay demands. Whereas in Ireland, real estate prices have dropped by 60% from their peak, in nominal terms, probably about 65% in real terms. In Spain, due to the collusion of the banking system and their unwillingness to recognize losses, housing costs have dropped very little and are still very, very high.
Why is that?
The Spanish banks have inherited the last 2 years of housing construction from real estate promoters, and they essentially have turned themselves into real estate companies. If they were to sell these apartments at any price near what the market would require to clear, most of the banks, with the possible exception of the two largest ones, would be effectively bankrupt. So it's understandable that bank management is reluctant to put itself out of a job. What is less understandable is that the Bank of Spain, which is in charge of regulating the banks, and the ECB indirectly have allowed them to do this for so long. But just to be an example, even after a roughly 15 to 20% drop, and again, it's very difficult to see exactly how much real estate prices have dropped in Spain, but because of the deliberate confusion with which banks are treating any pricing data, in a country where wages are perhaps 40% lower than the United States, the typical 100-square-meter apartment in the country, according to one of the main real estate sellers, cost nearly $300,000 at current exchange rates.
Which, as you say, is roughly twice the American price?
I think it's a bit over 50% above the mean. The mean price in the United States is about $190,000 to $200,000, so we're talking 50% above that.
With 40% lower incomes.
Yes. It's it's a sign of what's going on, that the ECB is pressuring Spain to lower its supposedly too high minimum wage, which is 640 euros a month, roughly a little bit $800, fully taxable, but is doing nothing to bring down the housing costs that those workers would have to pay.
And let's step back in history, the Spanish boom or bubble. What was that based on? Was it any more than housing froth, or was there actually anything that happened in the underlying fundamentals?
Well, it was mostly housing froth. To the extent that there was an underlying improvement in the product structure, it was a fairly significant investment, public investment in infrastructure. Spain has gleaming airports. Unfortunately, some of them no airline wants to fly to, but nevertheless, most of the investment in transportation, infrastructure primarily, was real. And I think it is a country whose productive ability would be quite high if only were given the chance to do so.
And who funded the housing bubble? Was that domestically financed, financed by German banks? Who's the sugar daddy?
Initially, it was not financed directly by German banks. Spain had a structural, one of its major structural transitions in the 20th century happened in the mid-80s, when the quasi-public industrial sector that had been developed under Franco developmental policies was dismantled. The justification back then was that it was horrendously inefficient and unable to compete with the emerging producers in Asia. There's actually a lot of truth to that. And the first serious increase in property prices and construction as the main engine of the Spanish economy took place in the late 80s after Spain joined the European Union. Initially, it was financed mostly out of internal funds, income from tourism primarily, as well as some European convergence funds that amounted to perhaps 2 to 3% of GDP, which don't sound like much, but can make the difference between a sustainable current account deficit and one that is not. The boom took a breather during the recession of the mid-90s in Spain, and then once Spain joined the euro, interest rates dropped to negative levels in real terms, and the core European banks starting to look for an outlet for the excess, for the surplus of capital, then it really exploded in earnest. And in fact, in the mid-2000s, construction accounted for nearly 20% of GDP, which I believe is actually twice as much as the equivalent figure for the United States, even at the height of the U.S. bubble.
I think Ireland was somewhere in that neighborhood, though.
Yes, the Irish and Spanish real estate booms actually progressed in parallel much of the time, and the peaks of valuation that they reached were very similar.
And let's just, you said something there about when Spain joined the euro, interest rates dropped very dramatically. That was because it's hard to remember the time. People thought Spain and Italy and the rest had become almost like Germany.
Almost like Germany, exactly like Germany. I remember a at some point in the mid-2000s, Spain actually paid slightly less for its interest on its debt than Germany did.
Well, those are different times. Now, let's the big guy to the east, Italy. How is that? How is that like or unlike Spain?
It's actually quite unlike Spain, and I think that that really belies the morality tale that we're hearing from Germany about the problem being profligate southern governments, because almost every peripheral country is different from the others, and there's not any story that really fits nicely all these countries. Italy did not have a housing bubble. Its real estate costs are not out of line. And outside of its private sector is much less indebted, both in absolute terms and in terms of debt to the rest of the world. What it does have is considerably higher level of starting debt. Now, frankly, I am really puzzled that Italy is at the center of the crisis, and in fact, it's paying interest rates that are nearly 1.5 points higher than Spain, because though it is true that its level of public debt is higher than Spain's, all of the measures of sustainability are much better. Italian households have very low debt. In order to, the best explanation I found is that Italians don't pay taxes, they buy the government's debt instead. And that, at least until recently, that was very much the case. The country has a small current account surplus and has had one for much of the last decade, which means that it actually provides net financing to the rest of the world rather than borrowing from it.
What this all means is that if weren't for investor panic, Italy should be able to sustain itself.
Absolutely. It has some long-term sustainability issues in that it's had sluggish growth. Well, what used to be considered sluggish growth, I guess, 1 to 1.5% growth would be like some sort of a macroeconomic nirvana right now in Europe. But clearly nothing that would have been a problem for decades.
Now, for a long while, it looked like Germany was going to escape the downdraft that's been affecting peripheral Europe, but now there are some signs of cracks showing in the German wonder, aren't there?
Yes, I mean, it's just I never quite understood. I frankly am very puzzled by the German attitude, because normally when a country's or a set of policymakers' attitudes seem to not make any sense, once you dig in, you find some material interest that explains things. And I can't for the life of me find that material interest negative of Germany. Their exports to Southern Europe are, I believe, 4 to 5 times as large as their exports to the Pacific Rim. So the idea that Germany can decouple from countries that account for close to 40% of Eurozone GDP is ludicrous. I don't know who profits by massive stagnation, misery, and unemployment. I really can't make it out.
Could it just be a combination of character and ideology that's driving this? I mean, that normally makes no sense, but as you say, one scratches one head trying to find a better explanation.
I'm very reluctant to choose arguments of national character. I think they're very slippery and can lead to very dangerous conclusions, but I honestly cannot find I can't find a better argument than to say that Germans find something deeply satisfying psychologically about inflicting this kind of pain on people that they see as profligate.
Perhaps I need to find an expert in German toilet training habits. I'm speaking with Enrique Diaz-Alvarez, who is the chief strategist for Ebury Partners. Speaking of the Germans, the European Central Bank, which has been acting essentially as a branch of the German government, they have a relatively new head, an Italian, Mario Draghi. How's he turning out?
Frankly, it is turning out a little better than I expected. I think that Draghi has been doing about as much as he can get away with, given complete German dominance of institutions and ideology around Frankfurt, which is where the ECB is based. Though direct ECB financing, European Central Bank financing of the struggling sovereigns is absolutely forbidden by the Germans, he has done the next best thing, which is to first flood the banks with liquidity. It offered an unlimited take-up of basically as much money as the banks wanted to borrow at the very low rate of 1%, no questions asked, and the banks borrowed 500 billion euros. about $800 billion, roughly $650 billion. The number keeps dropping as the euro drops. And in addition to that, the Bank of Italy and the Bank of Spain, which are essentially branches of the European Central Bank, made it clear to their domestic banks that they were expected to borrow as much as they possibly could and use that money to support auctions of debt by the respective sovereigns. So the at least we have seen stabilization of Spanish and Italian rates at levels that are still way too high and probably unsustainable over the medium and long term, but Spain and Italy both can still borrow money. And given this new attitude by the European Central Bank, I expect that they will continue to be able to borrow money for at least 2012.
And now let's look at Britain, which is outside the euro. It has embraced a severe austerity program, and what do they have to show for it?
Well, nothing much. Both the British economy and the currency are what I would call what we call in the trade a low beta version of the European economy. They're probably in something close to a recession right now, but not quite as deep as the Eurozone recession is supposed to go. But they do have one tremendous advantage over Europe, and it's that given that they have their own currency and their own central bank, nobody questions that their sovereign debt, and in fact, the British government can finance itself at the lowest rates, I think, in history right now. And they still have absorbed enough of the austerian mentality that the economy is not doing well, but neither is it collapsing. Their unemployment is somewhere around 7%, which, looking at it from the 23% unemployment rate that we have in Spain, looks pretty good.
So do you think the euro can hold together for this?
Frankly, I remember you asked me this question a year and a half ago, and I believe my answer was yes. I am not so sure. I think that the euro is increasingly being associated, even in places like Spain that used to be enthusiastically pro-European and in favor of the common currency. The euro is starting to be seen as a proxy for misery, stagnation, unemployment, and suffering. And I don't see that changing over the next year or two. And whereas I think the situation is sustainable over the next 6 to 12 months, I don't know if it is beyond that time horizon.
Now, were more rational people in control, or were you in control, which may or may not be the same thing? What's the way out?
Well, clearly, Northern European demand needs to expand. German, Dutch, perhaps Austrian, even French demand need to grow. They have been severely repressed over the last 10 years. I do understand the German concerns that without pressure from the ECB, the structural adjustments that do need to happen in Spain, and I'm thinking more in terms of the critical issue of real estate costs, housing costs, etc., would not happen. But on the other hand, there has to be a way out for these countries to grow. If their domestic sectors are going to be stagnant or worse for the next 10 years, the only way out is exports. And the only conceivable destination for a significant increase, even a doubling over 10 years of Spanish exports and Italian exports, are the Northern European countries. Absent a demand policy, a sustained demand expansion from Germany primarily, the euro is not sustainable.
What about the governance side? Can you have a common currency with all these different national governments pulling in different directions?
To be honest, right now we don't have all these governments pulling in different directions. Spain, the new Spanish government, essentially admitted that the latest austerity measures had been dictated by the ECB and there was no choice. The ECB essentially forced Berlusconi out of power and had him replaced by a pro-ECB technocrat, Monti. So I think that the different governments pulling in different directions problem has been, for now at least, eliminated. The Germans are essentially getting all the peripheral countries to do exactly what they want to do.
Oh, and what about the political mood? I mean, do people in Spain kind of resent the German jackboot on their neck?
Not yet. When you talk about Spain, you probably talk with Ireland about possibly the most pro-European Union country traditionally in Europe. We're not talking this is not the same situation as in Greece. That has a healthy tradition of Germanophobia, quite justified possibly. Surprisingly, the resentment in Spain, at least, is directed primarily against its own elites, its own politicians, its own bankers, and so far I am seeing very little blaming of Germany and Frankfurt for the plight of the Spanish economy, though I would expect that will change after the change of government does not bring any relief to the unemployment situation, quite the opposite.
What is the content of the resentment of elites and bankers? Because people certainly participated in the housing bubble themselves.
Well, yes, they did. And that's a dilemma, because people are blaming bankers, not so much for running a generational Ponzi scheme, but for having ended the party a little too early. And to the extent that demands have been articulated, the demands are a little worrisome. They seem to be for the credit to flow again to the real estate sector so that we can build yet more unnecessary apartments so that prices can continue to go up to 15 to 20% a year. So, again, and I think that here's where Spain is quite different from Ireland, the structural transition away from the bubble real estate economy is stillborn. It hasn't happened yet.
And to return to where we started this, do you think the United States can decouple from Europe's problems?
Yeah, I think so. I think that, for instance, the housing sector in the United States is far more important than exports to Europe. I think that that if you get some sort of virtuous cycle between moderately increasing employment and increased demand for housing in a context of a housing sector that's trying to develop some local shortages of housing after 4 years of bust, I think that the U.S. can easily sustain 2 to 3% growth in spite of the European crisis.
And what about any mechanisms of financial blowback, freezing up the interbank market, causing problems in the U.S.? How serious a threat is that?
I don't think it's very serious. I think the Federal Reserve has done a masterful job of insulating American banks from the consequences of any drying up of credit. And I think that if the Federal Reserve keeps its aggressive, proactive policy of intervening in markets the moment any stress or any cracks develop, I think that the potential for contagion of the European crisis to the U.S. is being somewhat overstated.
Now, certainly there's a lot of resentment to the way the Fed hand out money during the heat of the crisis, but they've done a not bad job for the last few years, it seems to me.
Frankly, the Federal Reserve is probably, since the Lehman Brothers crisis at least, has done an excellent job, and I think that they seem to be one of the few remaining sane, powerful institutions in the Western world.
And we've actually seen in the last few days the people around the Fed talking about some debt write-offs, mortgage debt write-offs, and a generally constructive housing policy, which is not coming out of the elected government.
Yes. I mean, it's always very dangerous to rely on unelected bureaucrats to do the right thing rather than elected officials. But frankly, coming from Spain and spending half my time there, I look at the Federal Reserve in Washington with something like jealousy.
That was Enrique Diaz-Alvarez, Chief Strategist for the foreign exchange firm Eberry Partners. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. This program is first being broadcast over the long Martin Luther King holiday weekend, although some of you may hear it later. King's actual birthday is Sunday, January 15th. The pig systems ideology machine has sanitized King's memory considerably. As a corrective to that, let's listen to some of his speech against the Vietnam War, delivered at Riverside Church in New York in April 1967, almost a year to the day before his assassination. And from that, and its evocation of a country facing spiritual death, which the less upbeat among us might diagnose as having already happened, we'll go to a bit of Mahler's Resurrection Symphony, performed by the Vienna Philharmonic under Pierre Boulez. Till next week, bye.
We must rapidly begin the shift from a thing-oriented society to a person-oriented society, when machines and computers, profit motives and property rights are considered more important than people. The giant triplets of racism, extreme materialism, and militarism are incapable of being conquered. True compassion is more than flinging a coin to a beggar. It comes to see that an edifice which produces beggars needs restructuring. This business of burning human beings with napalm, filling our nation's homes with orphans and widows, of injecting poisonous drugs of hate into the veins of peoples normally human, sending men home from dark and bloody battlefields physically handicapped and psychologically deranged, cannot be reconciled with wisdom, justice, and love. A nation that continues year after year to spend more money on military defense than on programs of social uplift is approaching spiritual death.